Today I'm going to talk about Rachel Mary Parsons. Rachel Parsons was the only daughter of the world-famous engineer Sir Charles Parsons. Sir Charles Parsons developed the world's first practical steam turbine for use in ships and power stations, among other applications. His inventions made electricity affordable and therefore available to everyone. He opened his company C.A. Parsons in 1889, which went on well after his death to employ thousands of people, bringing much prosperity to Tyneside. And if you go to the Discovery Museum in Newcastle, you are greeted by his yacht, Turbinia, launched in 1894, which was the world's first steam turbine-driven vessel and sparked a revolution in ship propulsion. Now, you can't talk about Rachel Parsons without talking about her upbringing during a time when her father was creating a global industry to make steam turbines. But also, you can't talk about Rachel without talking about the struggles faced by women. So let's try and go way back to the 1800s. Women were seen as the weaker sex. Women didn't work like they do now. They got married, had babies, stayed at home, and were barred from undertaking university degrees. So, women didn't have their own income. If they weren't married yet, they often worked in service as a maid, perhaps in a large house, cooking and cleaning. Many poorly educated young women appear on the census documents of that era as servants. Women who didn't get married at all would now be called single, but back then were called spinsters and were considered not good enough to get a husband. In 1857, the Matrimonial Causes Act gave women the right to divorce their husbands if, for example, they were abusive. But women depended on their husbands for money, so had no choice but to remain in a miserable marriage. Back then, women became the property of their husband. You could argue this could still be seen today with women taking their husband's surname when they get married. Women could not vote. As the engineering institutions and the engineering trade unions developed in the 19th century, they adopted a deliberate policy of excluding women. Rachel was born in 1885. She attended school and college, and there were many stories about her spending hours in the labs and workshops at home with her father, conducting experiments and taking part in marine trials. Her mother also encouraged her to have an interest in engineering, so from that point of view, she was unique for her time. She definitely had opportunities that most girls her age would not have had, but the important thing is that she went on to put that background to good use. Rachel is mentioned in a booklet by Ken Smith about Turbinia, which describes how she accompanied her father and the crew during voyages up and down the mouth of the River Tyne, and how on one occasion Turbinia spotted a warship built at Armstrong's in Scotswood Road. Seeing this as a challenge, they battened down the hatches and rapidly overtook the ship, which gave a good-humoured blast on its siren to acknowledge Turbinia's superiority of speed. The acceleration caused a huge bow wave to come over deck, soaking Rachel and everyone else aboard. I am guessing she loved every minute of it, though. Another ship you might have heard of is Mauritania. Mauritania was, in her day, the biggest liner, holding the blue ribbon for the fastest Atlantic crossing from 1907 through to 1929. Built by Swan Hunter and Wigham Richardson Limited at Wall's End, the Mauritania's four steam turbine engines were made by Parsons. In 1909, Rachel accompanied her father across the Atlantic on the Mauritania, which again I am guessing would have been a really exciting thing for a young woman. As a little girl, she lived at Elveston Hall in Wrighton and then Holland Hall in Wylam. I've been to Holland many times and the house has a fabulous stable block, which is now a residence, and acres of fields with large ponds. You can imagine the Parsons' children riding their horses around the grounds and exploring in amongst the trees there. Her father used the ponds at all of their properties for conducting experiments. She witnessed him at the pond at home using salmon fishing line pulleys and weights to tow model boats whilst designing the hull for Turbinia. One such model is about 2 foot long and I believe is held at the Discovery Museum in Newcastle. Now, before I go on, I just want to talk a little bit about engineering. What exactly is engineering in terms of a career? I've had the word engineer in my job title for 30 years, but the range of tasks I've undertaken is really diverse. It's often described as designing or building machines or equipment. So you might think they only deal with machinery, but engineers are involved in everything from complex Formula One cars to basic furniture. They look at the materials used to make things, the chemicals to preserve them. They calculate the ability to withstand stresses, like, for example, the weight of someone sitting on a chair. And they design and make a lot of fun things, like the rides in theme parks. Anyway, back to Rachel and her experience of becoming an engineer. So in 1910, Rachel Parsons attended Cambridge and became one of the first three women to study mechanical sciences. It was very rare at the time for women to go to university at all, and especially in the fields of engineering and science. However, women were barred from becoming full members of the university, which meant they were ineligible for a degree. And that didn't change until 1948. At that time, men banded together to stop women being allowed to vote in elections because women were not thought capable of sound independent judgment. In 1914, Rachel was a young woman in her late 20s and still had her whole life ahead of her. But when World War I broke out, she was to start taking on extraordinary responsibility for a woman of her age. Her brother Algernon went to war, and at that point, nobody knew how long the war was going to last. So in 1915, Rachel was appointed a temporary director at her father's company to replace Algernon. Here's an extract from the actual board meeting minutes, which are in Tynanweir archives at the Discovery Museum. On the 15th of December 1915, it is resolved that Miss Rachel Parsons be appointed a director of the company in place of Captain A.G. Parsons, and Captain A.G. Parsons be granted 6 months' leave of absence. Here's also an extract from F.G.H. Bedford's memoirs, which are also in Tynanweir archives at the Discovery Museum. Bedford was the managing director at Parsons from 1931 to 1945, and he said, "In order to compensate for the gaps caused by enlistment, the engineering employers, in agreement with the unions, agreed to the introduction of a system of dilution of labour. Women were introduced into the shops for the first time, and at many jobs they proved very competent. Miss Parsons came to the works to supervise the women workers. She was made temporary director, but she only appeared at two meetings before leaving to take up war work in London, and she never returned to Heaton." He also says, and I love this bit, "One of the bargaining points for introducing dilution was that men should be allowed to smoke in the shops during working hours." What had happened was a Ministry of Munitions had been established under David Lloyd George. Rachel Parsons joined the training department in London. She went on to instruct thousands of women to perform a multitude of mechanical tasks, from assembling aircraft parts to installing electrical wiring on battleships and making telescopes, periscopes, searchlights and shells. So, when we think about women during World War One, I'd like to quote the welfare supervisor of the Ministry of Munitions, Yeats, who describes how women were initially given repetitive tasks, but later how they proved themselves as completely competent engineers. She says, "As soon as it was made known that their services were required, they came forward in their hundreds of thousands. Women were rapidly initiated in the simple repetition processes of shell making and shell filling. The discovery of the employers of the potentialities of women's work in the engineering trades soon led to a development of the instruction of female students in the training centres. More advanced machine work was added to the curriculum. As well as tuition in aeroplane woodwork and construction, in core making and moulding, in draftsmanship and electrical work, in optical instrument making, including the delicate and highly skilled work of lens and prism making. Yeats goes on to tell us, as Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, remarked in a speech, "I do not know what would have happened to this land when the men had to go away fighting if the women had not come forward and done their share of the work. It would have been utterly impossible for us to have waged a successful war, had it not been for the skill and ardour, enthusiasm and industry which the women of the country have thrown into the work of the war." In 1918, war ended. Rachel became a member of the Royal Institution, one of Britain's leading scientific bodies. Women got the vote. And there was a great deal of appetite for change. Women had shown what they could do. Women had made progress in becoming doctors, lawyers, etc. However, the door was slammed firmly shut against women engineers. Sadly, this meant all the women who had enjoyed being trained, had got used to having good jobs and being well paid, etc., suddenly this was taken from them. And Rachel's mother, Catherine Parsons, in particular, recognised that banning women from the factories represented a huge waste of human talent and a huge waste of the money spent on training them. Rachel and Catherine Parsons both argued strongly for women to be retained in engineering jobs and set about starting the Women's Engineering Society in 1919, which still exists today. Rachel became not only a founder, but the first president of the Women's Engineering Society. This became a busy period in Rachel's life. Now in her mid-30s, Rachel had also become an associate member of the Institute of Naval Architects. She also joined the Royal Institute of International Affairs. She turned to politics. She was elected to the London County Council, stood for Parliament in the election of 1923 when there were only two female MPs. This was pioneering, but it was virtually impossible, and she did not succeed. She had campaigned energetically throughout her life for women's employment rights, but lost both her parents in the early 1930s, and was now herself well into her 40s. And for Rachel, things started to take a different turn. As time went on, it seems Rachel became disappointed in all the things that were previously motivating her. She spent a period of time as a society hostess, throwing parties at her homes in Mayfair and Belgravia, attending highlights of the social season such as Royal Ascot, and spending the winter in Bermuda and Palm Beach. But if you were to compare that lifestyle to today's celebrity culture, for example, it becomes clear that money does not buy happiness, and it can buy the wrong sort of friends. To summarise this period, I quote from Henrietta Heale's book, Magnificent Women and Their Revolutionary Machines. She says, "Having little alternative, Rachel turned to a socially conventional life that neither suited nor satisfied her, and as she grew older, she was beset by suspicion about other people's motives, which could make her behaviour seem hostile." So what happened to her? Well, later on she went back to one of her childhood roots of having horses and bought racing stables. So in 1947, after World War II, Rachel bought the 2,600-acre Branches Park estate near Newmarket, Suffolk, where she built up a large stud farm. In 1954, she bought Lansdowne House Racing Stable in Falmouth Avenue in Newmarket. Rachel owned an astonishing 72 horses and had several winners from her stables. Names like Cavalleria, Golden God and Fraser Melba, the dear door. But socially, she was becoming isolated and was increasingly perceived as eccentric. In 1956, Rachel moved into a few rooms in Lansdowne House because she became apprehensive of living alone at Branches Park. Rachel was in her early 70s now, well off, living alone, but would later be described as a judge as unpleasant and quarrelsome. On Sunday, the 1st of July 1956, Rachel had been to the cinema and returned home to an intruder, Dennis Pratt, a 25-year-old stableman and former employee. Pratt was later charged with her murder, but convicted of manslaughter on the grounds of provocation. He got 10 years, rather than the death penalty for murder. In court, Michael Havers went about totally destroying Rachel's character by calling hostile witnesses and suggesting to the jury that Rachel had it coming. It was as if Rachel, rather than Pratt, were on trial. As a rich, independent spinster with a mind of her own, she was widely regarded as a threat. This was an early example of what, in many cases of violence against women, we now call victim blaming. By the way, Michael Havers was the father of Nigel Havers. He was in Coronation Street. And if anyone's listening of a certain age, you might remember a film called Chariots of Fire, which won several Oscars in the early 80s. Anyway, Nigel was in it. And Michael Havers went on to become Lord Michael Havers and served briefly as England's top legal official. He famously prosecuted two Irish Republican Army bombing cases that were both later overturned. So, I have many questions. Why are there so few photographs of this famous woman and none of her brother as an adult? Why did the press at the time focus on her eccentricities instead of her contribution to engineering and her contribution to the country during World War I? Why did she never get married? How can they say she provoked Dennis Pratt when he was intruding at her house late at night? Many of these sorts of questions can be answered in Henrietta Heale's book, but whichever way you look at it, what a tragic end. I'd like to finish by reading an article from the Times obituary column of the 18th of July 1956, written by Anne Parsons, Countess of Ross, who was related to Rachel by marriage. She wrote, "There is a loneliness unparalleled in the role of an immensely rich old maid, a role that becomes more difficult to play with years. It is easy from the fireside of a happy home circle to pronounce smugly the good that a spinster relation or friend could or should have done with their wealth, unheedful of their tortured complexes, or what could have been made of their lives. Much has been written and said of the eccentricities and of the curious and reclusive life of Rachel Parsons, which ended in dramatic tragedy. Rachel was no ordinary woman, blessed with simple feminine tastes and domestic ability, the daughter of one of the greatest scientific geniuses that this country has ever produced. She inherited much of her father's brilliant technical brain and volcanic temperament. Many still remember the lovable, headstrong and attractive girl, brimming over with enthusiasm and with her father's desire to achieve. They remember her uncommon ability to grasp mathematics, for she did not secure unprecedented honours at Cambridge, where she was the first woman to take the mechanical sciences tripos, but they also remember her unusual upbringing in an atmosphere dedicated to and absorbed in science and inventions, mixed with the Victorian restricting decorum that forbade the outlet of a career to such a girl. Had she been young today, when full equality in careers for men and women exists, what fields of honour in the world of science might not have been hers, with all eccentricities accepted?"